VQA has evolved, and we're now really big in cattle handling and biosecurity. That's probably one area that we are not prepared for as an industry when it comes to biosecurity. You know, anytime that I give a training with truckers and I say, have you ever hauled pigs before? If they have, I say, tell these guys what it's like hauling pigs from a biosecurity standpoint. And, you know, they go through everything I want to talk about. They got to wear new coveralls, have clean boots or booties on. You know, they're not allowed out of the truck on some operations. Mm-hmm. And when they say that stuff, and the big thing is cleaning trailer between every load. That's a biggie, right? And so when they get to hear that, I say the beef industry ain't like that now. But if we have a foreign animal disease, such as foot and mouth disease, come into the United States and impact our cow herd, that's what we're going to see. We're going to see those type of biosecurity measures being implemented in order to protect the herd as best we can.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lalamond Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
All right, Jesse, thanks for jumping on the podcast. I'm excited to have you here today. I've known Jesse for quite a while. He's a colleague of mine when I was on faculty at University of Nebraska several years back. And we even go back a little further than that. Jesse once emailed me to go to grad school about if I had a position opening when I was at University of Tennessee. And lucky for Jesse, because how his path took from then, I didn't have a position. And it ended up very well for Jesse. And Jesse, thanks for coming on the podcast. You know, once we get started, you know, go through that path of, you know, how you grew up and how you got involved in ag, and then how that led you to where you're doing today, and what is your role today with University of Nebraska?
Yeah, so growing up, I'm from northeastern Kentucky, Lewis County, Kentucky, to be exact. My grandparents on both sides of my family were in the ag industry, heavily involved in either raising tobacco, dairy operation, beef cattle operation. And then my uncle, he was actually pretty big into horses there for a while as well, coming from Kentucky. It makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. With my family, we didn't really have the land to really have cattle or anything like that. We always did raise a beef calf every year. That was something that probably started to pique my interest in agriculture, I would say. And then we were surrounded by cow-calf operations. My mom always makes a joke with people when people ask about, well, it was like with me and my siblings, I have two other siblings growing up. And she would say, you know, my brother, who's older than me, he was always in front of a video game. My sister, who's younger than me, was always had her head buried in a book reading. And then Jesse, we never knew where he was. And that's because I was always outside. I was gone, and I would not show up until after dark. And usually I'd come in on a bicycle holding a flashlight. You know, and that's just the way it was. I'd go to my neighbor's operations because they had livestock, whether it be cattle, horses, or goats, one neighbor had at one point in time, and just eager to learn and understand more about it. So that's what got me started there. And then, you know, graduated high school, went to college at Morehead State University in Morehead, Kentucky. So pretty close to the house, but they had a really good hands-on learning experience for students. Animal science classes were small, with just about 20 kids to a class, you know. So you were able to have that intimate relationship, essentially, with the material and your professor and learning that material. And then they had a university farm that you could actually live at. I lived there my senior year in order to just get more of that hands-on experience. And, you know, that sometimes was tough because you still had your classes you're trying to finish up. But when it came to calving time, you had calving checks to do. And it was on a 2-hour rotation of when you had to go. At the same time, they'd be lambing and farrowing, and you would have to go through those barns as well to make sure everything was going good.
It's one of the true measures of sustainability.
Yep.
is that generational sustainability. And so that's extremely important to so many cow-calf producers that, you know, they could sell out today and be millionaires, but it's the generational sustainability that they care about, is maintaining that ranch for the next generation of their family to have.
That's something that, you know, you were in Tennessee, so you understand that we get a lot of rain, right? And so sometimes running short on feed ain't a huge concern. It happens, it does, but it's nothing like out here where we're at now. And those producers, they're short on feed, many, they can go sell those animals, right?
Right.
Here, you do that, you're taking away so much genetics from your operation that you've worked years and years for.
Yep. Well, let's get us back on topic for the reason we have you on the podcast today. But it's been a little different slant on the podcast, which isn't bad. But let's move into, tell me about this Right Way to Right Time booklet that's just come out.
Yeah, so this is a document that we were working on with National Cattlemen's Beef Association. So what it is, it's all based on the results of the 2022 National Beef Quality Audit, the cow-bull section, essentially. So they do the audit split into two, where they look at just fed cattle. So those are all of our feedlot steers and heifers, and then the market cow and bull. So those are our coal animals that I like to say get a career change once they're done having calves, right? Mm-hmm. And so what it's about is the timely marketing of those animals to make sure that we're capturing all the value we possibly can. You know, we also had a contributor in here, Cattle Facts, helped us work on this just to show how much value a producer could be leaving on the table. Now, I don't know if this is online yet. It should be coming real soon. It might be. I just didn't check before I was able to get on here. I have a printed version, so I don't really look at the online one. But what it is all about is the defects that we might have, or defects that some folks don't consider as a defect. So let's talk about body condition scoring, one of your favorite topics. Yep. You've taught me a lot about it when you were here at UNL. And so the value the producers leave on the table when they don't market that animal as a body condition score of 4 and they send it as a 2. And, you know, 'cause they're trying to wait for that animal to turn around. Well, you wait too long. If she's going downhill and not recovering, it's time to get her on the truck and get her out of there.
Right. Right.
Not just from a value perspective, but also an animal welfare perspective. So I am the BQA guy, so I got to link it back to that animal welfare component. You know, when those animals are in poor condition, they don't have the energy stores to really make that trip. And what I mean by that is transportation is one of the most stressful times in an animal's life. They burn a lot of energy to maintain their balance. And, you know, the stress that's on them when they're getting on a truck in an unfamiliar place, driving down the road, right? And so that's why we want to market those animals at a better body condition score. Another defect that some people might not think about, and I actually had this discussion with a producer not too long ago. I asked them a question. Do you think a cow with a full bag going into the plant is a problem? And with full bag, I mean a bag with milk in it. And she said, no. And then she said, well, wait a second. It depends on what that udder looks like. If they got mastitis or whatever. I said, let's pretend it's a healthy bag, perfectly fine. It's just got milk in it. I don't see a problem with that, was her response. Well, the problem is when we have that animal hanging on the rail and they go to gut that animal, if they pop that bag and that milk gets on the meat, we have to trim all of that meat off because it's considered an adulterant, because it's not naturally occurring there. And what I mean by there in that spot is milk doesn't occur on the ribs or down the belly.
Right.
It's in the bag. And so we have the same problem with arthritic joints of old cows. If we pop that joint and that fluid comes out, that's an adulterant. And so marketing these animals when they don't have those defects. Another big topic we get into in this document is the hidden defect. And that hidden defect, one that we talk about, is birdshot. So, you know, we've known that birdshot is a problem in the industry, you know, 30 years ago. And we thought maybe we've cleaned up our act. But still today, at 100% of the coal plants we went to, they were reporting birdshot, with 50% of those reporting consumer complaints. That's meaning the birdshot got out of the beef packing plant. And that's a big concern for us. We did do a big presentation on this down at the cattle industry convention down in Orlando this year. And we had Golden State Foods come in, Dr. Wayne Morgan. He's VP at that company, and he presented on it. And he actually was showing slides in the data they have from their company of the amount of bird shot that they find in the ground. And when it comes down to it, if they accident, if the X-ray doesn't catch or something, and it goes into the ground and then gets picked up by by metal detectors, and it's already went through that grinder, they have to throw away approximately about 60,000 pounds of beef because a BB just got turned into fine shavings and we can't find it now. And so they just have to tank the whole combo. And so it's a really big concern that we have, and we're truly trying to bring that attention to producers. And, you know, a lot of producers, you know, I show evidence of birdshot and uses of birdshot in my BQA presentations. And, you know, they're just kind of in shock and awe when they don't do it. And they're asking, you know, how's this happening? Is it bird hunters when we let people bird hunt on corn stalks when we run cows on corn stalks? And I show them the evidence from social media of actual producers either admitting to the use of birdshot or actually recording themselves doing it. And when I show them that, that's when their jaws really hit the floor.
Right.
And they're like, these people should not be in the industry. And
no.
They have a point on that, and that they are jeopardizing your way of life.
Correct.
When they do practices like that. So that's really what we're talking about in this document, is just defects that we have in cull cows and how to really remember that that animal, even though she's raising calves for you now, she's eventually going to become beef and enter the supply chain. And we want to make sure we're sending the best product possible even through that supply chain.
Let's step back a second. And so you're talking about defects. And a lot of times when we think about defects, you know, there may be some kind of a genetic defect that's causing issues, or what's the definition that BQA has for defect? Because you covered like a full bag, and that's something producers do not think about, is marketing a cow that you maybe just weaned that calf. You want to get that cow out of there because of, like you said, body condition score. Mm-hmm. And she's in good condition. Feed quality may be declining, and I want to get rid of her because the market is whatever right now. Right. But she has that bag on her, and it's going to take, you know, a couple of weeks for that bag to really dry up.
Yep.
And so that's something we don't think about as a defect. And so can you step back and give a definition of what a defect is, so producers have an understanding of some common defects that can cause issues from the meat quality standpoint down the road?
Yeah. So based on the defects that we look at in beef production, because I really don't know if BQA has ever defined it clearly, but I would say a defect would be labeled as something that would impact the quality or safety of that beef product.
Or quantity, right?
Or quantity. Exactly. Because, you know, we talk about bruising a lot, right? And that in the National Beef Quality Audit, the quantity of that defect is really attributed to how big that bruise is. So in the last, so in 2016 was the previous audit, you know, our bruising, it was, you know, I think about 40% of carcasses had bruises on them. Bruising has actually went up going into 2022. So over 50% of carcasses have a bruise on it. I believe it's about 2% have four or more bruises. And then the severity of the bruises have also gotten worse. And so what I mean by severity is they kind of categorize these by a minor bruise, which is about a deck of cards of beef we're going to cut off. And then we go up to minor. Major. I know it goes up to 10 pounds. We'll take about 10 pounds of beef off.
Right.
Then we go up to major bruises, which is up to 40 pounds of beef. And then critical, where they'll throw the whole wholesale away. So, you know, you think about the loin or the rib. I'm going to pick on those two because those are the major areas where the bruising is occurring based on those audit results. And so if we have a critical bruise there, they just took the most valuable wholesale cuts and just tanked them. Yep. And so that goes into quantity of how much beef we're throwing away. So, you know, in 2016, they haven't released the dollar figure yet on how much we're losing and bruising a year. But I can tell you, 2016, that was the audit that I worked on when I was still at NCBA. We were throwing away $62 million just in bruising alone. Now, we'll never get rid of all the bruises because, right, as you know, cattle are social animals. They beat up on each other, right? But if we can change the way we handle them, we can alter our handling facilities to try to limit the amount of bruising. That's something that we could do to really help it.
What are some of the leading causes that are leading, especially with the increase in bruising? And I'm guessing that may be loin bruising, but what are the increasing, and what's the reason for these increase in bruises?
Yeah, you know, I would attribute it to our cattle were getting bigger. The other day, somebody said, so when I was in grad school, I was trying to think of how heavy my cattle were when they would slaughter. And I feel like they were only like 1,400 pounds, about that. And then Dr. Knopfinger was giving a presentation. He said 1,660 of some fat steers going. I was like, holy cow. And so cattle are getting bigger. We know that. Yeah. Well, our trucks don't get bigger. Trailers don't get bigger inside because overpasses don't go up, right? And the industry is trying to do the best they can to fix this. So I work with a trucking company out of Arapahoe, and they've made changes to their trailer design inside to where the ramp to the top deck does not slide out anymore. It's a fold down. And that gives about 4 inches for those animals to drop down into the belly. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot of room, but 4 inches is pretty good clearance for those animals that were just hot tall enough to scrape their backs. And then they're extending the basket chute. So what I mean by that is those steps that go down to the bottom, they're adding on, I believe, 3 additional steps to where it goes in flush with the floor. And it, to the cattle's eye, it prevents them from seeing that ledge to where they want to jump. And when they jump, they hit their back. So there's some really good research out of K-State University where Dr. Tiffany Lee and Dr. Dan Thompson actually looked at bruising and transportation. We can really attribute a lot of that bruising to transportation. If you ever have the opportunity to go in a packing plant, just go right where they're pulling the hides off and just stand there for maybe an hour and see how many bruises you see down the top line. Now, I will say it all depends on what kind of cattle are being harvested that day. If you go to a plant where they take dairy, I guarantee you, you're going to see a chunk of them that have a top line bruise right down their backbone just because they're so tall. So, that's where we're really seeing a lot of that bruising.
Primarily, they're coming off of cattle that were in the belly of the truck and jumping down into the belly instead of maybe walking or, and so, and I think there's been a push for, you know, like you're talking about the trucking company for Arapahoe. I think, isn't there been a push of updating trucks entirely across the United States because of the research by BQA and these audits of showing where this bruising is occurring at?
Yeah. We really do want to push that. And I always say this in my trainings because I understand it. So I have a 1991 Featherlite aluminum trailer. It's 33 years old, but it looks like it's showroom floor already. And so when you got a cattle pot that's that old and still functional, why would you trade in? So right. I would challenge these trailer companies to have some kind of trade-in incentive in order to do that, get those new trailers out on the road and get those old ones off. But I mean, it's never, I like to watch old farm machinery auctions around here because I can always get a good deal, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a cattle pot on one right now that's like an 87, and somebody's going to buy that and somebody's going to put that to use because it's still functional. And so right. I think that's a challenge we're going to have for a good while.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And as long as cattle keep getting a little bit bigger. So
that's probably not changing anytime soon either. So
No, I don't see that.
So tell us about your role with Nebraska Extension and what you do with Extension, but also with BQA.
Yeah. So I am the BQA state coordinator. So Beef Quality Assurance Program has been around for 80 years. It all really started back when we were having a problem with violative residues. So you give an antibiotic or you give some vaccines or pour on, some of those products have withdrawal periods. And if you don't wait for the withdrawal period to pass and you market that animal, you're going to send up a violative residue at the packing plant. during that time when that was happening, USDA Food Inspection Service was actually going to start releasing more government regulation on producers to prevent this from happening. And so I don't know what that would have looked like back then, but we had some veterinarians actually here in Nebraska and some feed yards kind of step up to the plate and say, let us figure this out on our own. Let us try to figure out our own problem. And they developed a quality assurance program at that time that became the backbone of BQA. So a lot of people, when they think of BQA, they really think that it's just those violative residues and records and then shot placement, moving those shots up to the neck to prevent those injection site lesions. Because anytime you give a shot, you leave a lesion behind. That is any product. So for the cow-calf folks listening that might AI their cows, move your shots up to the front. Don't give them back there in the round.
And it does not increase the efficacy of giving that prostaglandin back there in the rump.
Yes, yes. The comment that I hear frequently is, I give it back there because it's closer to the ovaries. Well, we need to have an anat and phys class on here, Travis, maybe, so people can understand that it's all up here in the brain, right, where it all starts. So, but I've had producers tell me that, no kidding, and yeah. Don't want to laugh in their face, but I do want to educate them. And so we do have that conversation. But so that's what a lot of people think BQA is those things. Well, BQA has evolved, and we're now really big in cattle handling and biosecurity. That's probably one area that we are not prepared for as an industry when it comes to biosecurity. You know, anytime that I give a training with truckers and I say, have you ever hauled pigs before? If they have, I say, tell these guys what it's like hauling pigs from a biosecurity standpoint. And, you know, they go through everything I want to talk about. They got to wear new coveralls, have clean boots or booties on. You know, they're not allowed out of the truck on some operations. And when they say that stuff, and the big thing is cleaning trailer between every load. That's a biggie, right? And so when they get to hear that, I say the beef industry ain't like that now. But if we have a foreign animal disease, such as foot and mouth disease, come into the United States and impact our cow herd, that's what we're going to see. We're going to see those type of biosecurity measures being implemented in order to protect the herd as best we can. So that's something we talk about now big time. And just to get producers aware, because it's going to be so detrimental to the industry. We cover still the herd health stuff, still handling vaccines properly and making sure they, you know, that way we protect the efficacy of that product. You know, I did a BQA the other day, and I had a 6th generation rancher who was in his 80s come up to me and say, I did not know that you could overshake a vaccine. And I was like, yes, you can completely destroy that vaccine if you overshake it. Because he's used to when you mix, you need to shake it well to make sure it's mixed up good. Well, he didn't know that he could actually destroy his vaccine by overshaking. Many other topics that we cover that producers come up to me all the time and say, I did not know that. And, you know, it makes me feel good as an educator. But that's what I do in the state is I oversee the state program. About 40 states across the U.S. have a BQA state coordinator. They're usually involved in extension somehow or through your beef council. So if you're in a different state or in Nebraska listening, you know, that if you want to find out who your BQA coordinator is or a BQA training is, you can reach out to any of those and they can really help you out. But we do work alongside with National BQA. National takes on that heavy job of setting in those meetings with our Walmart and McDonald's and those end consumers that have concerns about how beef are raised. And they really push the message of, you shouldn't be concerned because we have producers that implement the beef quality assurance program that ensures a safe product and animals being handled the right way. I would say one of our biggest challenges we have is currently our cow-calf producers. You know, so if you're not familiar, for those listening, if you raise feedlot cattle and sell to the packer, you have to be BQA certified, especially with one of the big four. If you're a cow-calf producer, there's many that don't see the incentive. Now, Superior Livestock Auction has showed that incentive for any cattle going through their online sales, that when BQA is mentioned, it does increase the value of those animals. But at your local sell barn, no one's really dug deep into that data or collected that data and to really tell. And so there's cow-calf producers who don't see the value, and so they don't do it, and they don't see a reason why. Well, today I'm going to tell you why, but to tell your story to that end consumer of how you raise your cattle, and they don't need to worry when they take that beef to plate when they're feeding it to their families.
What's the process for someone, let's say not in Nebraska, but outside of Nebraska and maybe listening, what is the process that they can go through to get certified? And so, because each state, like say there's 40 states that have programs. So what if they're not in one of the 40 states, or just in general, what's the process that they can go through to be certified?
Yeah, so it's pretty easy. So I'm going to give you the generic website of BQA.org. That is the national website. As soon as you pull that up, there's a button that says get certified. You can click it and you can choose between in-person or online. So the benefits of in-person is you do go to a classroom and you get to be able to ask your questions to someone that is a professional in the beef industry to answer for you. And the great thing about them is if they don't know the answer to your question, I guarantee you they know someone that does. There's been many times where I get questions that I don't know the answer, but I have resources like all of our specialists that we have at UNL and our vet specialists that I can reach out to and ask those questions. So that's why I always push in-person learning first off. But for those states that don't have a BQA program, or states where maybe their program isn't as strong as one like Nebraska, where we have lots of trainings because of the number of producers we have all across the state, you can go online. The good thing about the online is it's available 24/7, absolutely free. You can sit down, start taking the courses, get up, walk away, go eat dinner and come back, right? Or you can come back 3 days later and finish. It keeps track of where you're at, as long as you remember your login information, right? So, but it is a valuable resource that you can use.
Oh, great. You know, and there are some schools now that have kids in, you know, middle school, high school that are going through this process as well, which I think is tremendous for the industry that we're getting them at that younger age.
Yes, yes. Anytime a college or university reaches out to me or high school to come and talk about BQA, I jump at the opportunity because we all know this. We all know that as we get older, we get set in our ways, right? Mm-hmm. And the whole thing about the industry and BQA is we need to be progressive and change how we do things. You know, there's things that we were doing in the 80s that we didn't realize was a problem. And now we know that. And so we need to fix that problem. And so when I get in front of these kids, I'm able to tell them that, you know, BQA didn't have this back in the 90s, but we have it today because we found out in the 2000s that we had a problem. Mm-hmm. And this is how we fix the problem. And so opening their minds to always being open. And so I always end my presentation with a slide that says, the seven most expensive words in the business are, we've always done it this way.
Yep.
And really getting them to open up their minds that, you know, yeah, we've always done it this way, but maybe we need to change our ways or always be open to changing. And again, it goes back to what I said at the beginning about, you know, me and my career path is you can always go back. If it's not working or it's not beneficial in your operation, you can always go back to the old way. What blows my mind is we have producers that are willing to experiment with the latest feed additive or implant or medicine, a vaccine, but they won't experiment with a different production practice that could benefit the welfare of that animal. Maybe they don't see the dollars of it, but what they need to remember is the dollars of it is that cow's taking care of you. She's paying your bills. You owe her the respect as well to take care of her. And so that's actually something we quoted in our latest document of Right Way, Right Time is she's done taking care of you so long, you take care of her now.
One thing that comes to mind on that side that producers don't always see the dollar benefit or don't think they see is preconditioning calves.
Yep.
And so to me, that is a no-brainer. If you're setting up that calf from a health standard of welfare moving forward. And so even if we don't always get that premium for it, it is part of the industry of doing the best of increasing the health and welfare of that calf post ranch.
Yep.
And that's sometimes hard for a producer to see and value, you know, that as their operation.
So for any cow-calf producer listening, I have set at Torrington Livestock, Ogallala Livestock, these operations sell, I mean, it's nothing for them during the fall run to have 4,000 head they're running through a day at those cells. So millions of cattle go through those cell barns.
Yep.
If you precondition your calves and you have them set up and the feed yard that purchases those calves, they excel when they get to the feed yard, the next year, you're going to have buyers fighting over your calves when they're bidding. I have seen it. I have seen operations come in there selling those calves, and they bring, you know, almost a quarter over what the other calves were selling, because they want those calves because they know they were handled, vaccinated, preconditioned the right way and how they're going to perform when they get to the feedlot. So it you might not understand what all your hard work is doing, and maybe at the cell barn you're at, maybe they're, you know, you don't have the right buyers there, but you go to these cell barns where these big buyers are, they will fight over calves, and it's something to see. It really is.
It is. One of my last questions, and maybe it's more of a concern where we're moving forward with technology, is darts.
Okay.
And so I get the benefit, and there's some instances why the need, but I have got a lot of concerns with producers using darts to treat a sick animal. Can you talk about that from a, you know, beef quality assurance standpoint and animal welfare?
Yes, this is a huge topic that we bring up in our trainings here in Nebraska, the ones that I'm at least, because I have connections with many people that are at these packing plants that send me pictures. And it is appalling that we are finding the entire dart, the whole component of the dart, not just the needle, in the beef product at the packing plant. One dart I got not too long ago was found in the tenderloin. And if you know where that's located, that's deep. Why is that dart in there so deep? So the first things first is a dart gun or a pole syringe, because I'm seeing a lot of those pop up, is not a replacement to a cattle handling facility.
Right.
You need to have that cattle handling facility still. Now, the benefits where I see where a dart gun might come in handy is when we might have cows out on stocks or out on leased pasture to where we don't have a portable handling facility. And so that technology might be useful. Here are the concerns with dart guns. Is you could strike sensitive tissue. I had a producer that was trying to dart one. He missed and hit the wrong calf in its lower leg, and it hit a nerve and drop that calf to where it could not get back up to, either the medicine had a bad reaction or something. The calf could not get back to its feet, and they had to euthanize that animal. So let's think about calf prices right now. We just lost a calf for no reason. Okay. Mm-hmm. So striking sensitive tissue. Inconsistencies to deliver the product. There are times that we dart that animal where one of two things will happen. Either the dart will release the medicine before it hits the animal, and so you just painted them with Draxxin, so you just wasted $50, right? Or it will hit the animal, deliver part of the medication, the dart will fall out, and you'll still have medication in that dart. And so technically, by law, you're off-label. You're extra-label drug use because you didn't give the right amount of medication based on the size of that animal. So that's a bad thing. And we could have failure to treat, which could cause antimicrobial resistance in these animals. And we don't want the day that Draxxin just doesn't work anymore. So we want to make sure we're given the right dose. There can be some tissue damage. Haven't seen much data on that yet. Does it leave a bruise behind when it hits? Biggest concern, again, goes back to those darts being found in the product, and then also location of giving those darts. So again, one of two things. We want to be giving our shots in the neck. I've got so many videos of producers darting cattle in the hip. I have one video where they're treating an animal with something and they have three darts hanging out of this cow's neck. Like, wouldn't it have just been as simple to catch her, run her through the chute, and give her shots like she needs them instead of shooting her three times with a dart gun?
Right.
And they're going to remember that. You know, a lot of people don't think cattle don't remember certain things. They're going to remember that, hey, when I see him run it coming towards me with something in his hand, I might get hurt. I might get hit with a dart in the neck or wherever and have a problem. So the other thing is if you're given a product that is not labeled for intramuscular, how can you prove that you're given that dart subcutaneously with a dart gun when you shoot them? So again, if it's a labeled sub-Q only and you give it in the muscle, you're off label. You're breaking federal law. And if you get caught doing that, they could potentially make an example out of you. For the first time ever, I had a producer bring up the other day that he was on the repeat violators list. That means he had a cow go to sale or go to slaughter that had a residue twice. And he remembers to this day getting that knock at the door from Mr. USDA man coming out of Texas. And the guy walked in and said, I want to see all your records. I want to see all your medicines in your medicine cabinet. And, you know, he was cleared because the way he was actually a cattle trader that bought cull cows. And so it wasn't his fault. He gave no medications to that animal. But the producer that marketed that animal to the sale barn where that cow didn't clear withdrawal periods, they got the knock on the door second. So that's something producers need to be aware of.
So, and there's instances that darts are very handy.
There are, absolutely. And I think that there's something that we can utilize in the industry. So we don't want to lose them. But if we continue to misuse them and cause food safety concerns at the packing plant, you know, I've already had packers kind of mention, like, we don't want to purchase cattle where a dart is going to be an issue for us.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, it could come down to if they know you're utilizing a dart gun on your property, they might not purchase your cattle. So we got to be very careful.
So if a producer had to use a dart, what's your recommendation of to use it?
Yeah. So if you're using a dart gun, I would be cognizant of what kind of medication you're putting in there. If it's something that's too thick that will not come through that dart, you know, you need to stay away from those thick consistency medications. I would also say, you know, we need to be darting in the neck. If it's a medication that requires less than 10 cc's, you can use a dart gun. If you got to give more than that, we need to be, you only are supposed to give 10 cc's per injection site. So you got to move that around. So I would not use a dart gun when you got to give more than 10 cc's. Recover that dart. After the dart falls out, go pick that dart up and make sure all the medication was administered to that animal. Also, we don't want to be leaving darts out there. We don't want darts that may have made it into the carcass, that animal going into the food supply chain. So it's really a lot about observation and using that tool, being within close range. That way, if it does administer the medication prior to it hitting the animal, you'll see that. You'll see it happen. And so you know that your dart was ineffective.
Right.
So that's kind of the recommendations I would give on using a dart gun. I would use it as a last chance tool. If there's any other way you can get around it, I would do that.
Good. No, those are great recommendations.
It's time for our famous three.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virvac's new Bovigen Platinum Vaccines. These four vaccines deliver quality protection against respiratory and reproductive diseases in the vaccine combinations you need to protect cattle at every life stage. Bovigen Platinum Vaccines are comprehensive and safe, have consistent supply made in the United States, and are backed by a six-month guarantee in the Bovigen Platinum Protection Program. Start your platinum protection at us.virvac.com/platinum protection or contact your Virvac representative.
So, Jesse, to wrap us up, I've got three questions for you.
Okay.
And so what is your favorite, your go-to beef-related resource book that, you know, that you go to often?
I'm going to cheat here and say Google Scholar. You know, I am in so many different types of information that I'm looking for that not one resource meets my goals. And so, and then not just one journal meets my goals. So, you know, it'd be easy to say Translational Animal Science or Journal of Animal Science, but, you know, I got to know what's all out there, because when we set something in BQA, that's another thing that should be mentioned is BQA isn't just stuff we pull out of the air. It's something that we've either observed a problem with in the industry or it's backed by peer-reviewed science coming from a university. So we just don't make up the guidelines in BQA. It has to be supported by science. So I'm going to go with Google Scholar and type it in whatever I'm looking for and whatever article it throws at me.
Now, Google Scholar is a great resource for searching for certain published papers across multiple journals at once.
Yes.
So what's your favorite book or resource that you highly recommend people read, visit, that's outside of ag?
So I have to travel across the state a lot, and I got really big into listening to audiobooks on tape, and probably one of my, I wouldn't say this is a resource, but it's just a story that I feel like everyone needs to hear to truly have an understanding of perseverance. And that would be Lone Survivor, the Marcus Luttrell story. Mm-hmm. If you haven't listened to that one on tape, it is, I mean, you can read it, sure, but hearing it being read to you, it is something that's just crazy. I know he does several interviews as well that you can go and watch and hear him telling the story, and it'll get your heart racing, you know, what he went through when he was overseas. And they made a movie on it. And if you've seen the movie, you haven't seen anything. You need to listen to the book, because there's so much the movie misses.
Oh, that's great. And lastly, in your opinion, what sets apart someone that's successful in the beef industry or ag in general?
Yeah. You know, the successful versus the unsuccessful, we've talked about it many times in this podcast, is having an open mind, mm-hmm. being willing to learn, being willing to discuss new ideas, not sticking your head in the sand and being blunt on something. You need to understand that, you know, the things that we knew 10 years ago are different from what we know now. We are continuously progressing, and you should continuously progress on your operation. I often hear some producers say, you know, we're putting certain people out of business and these guys are keep getting bigger. Well, the guys that are bigger, they were small ranchers at one point in time. Mm-hmm. They continue to be progressive, and that's why they got bigger, because they are running their operation as a true business and understanding that we got to adopt and implement new ideas to make us better. And so that's what I would challenge any producer is, be open-minded. Now, I know that open-mindedness sometimes comes with dollar bills, right, tied to it. But that's what you got to look at. You got to look at that cost-benefit analysis. And, you know, sometimes when it comes down to it, you know, I was discussing with a producer about a mineral program and implementing something like that. And I said, well, don't give it to your whole herd, because they're pretty big. I said, separate your herd. You've got different pastures out here. You've already got them separated. Feed them to those animals and see what happens. You're not having to buy as much, and you can see if there's a change, and then you can decide if you want to implement it across to the whole herd. You know, so you could always do a subsample of your operation to tell if you really want to dive in to that big investment.
Yeah, being open-minded and willing to make changes and listen is crucial. And so many times we get stuck in, as you said earlier, is we've always done it this way.
Yeah,
you know, I've heard people say, you know, with this increase in technology and beef production today, I've heard producers say in one mouth, say technology is bad and it'll never be adopted. And the next second they'll say how much reproductive technology has helped their operation. Mm-hmm. And so the willingness to adopt and be an early adopter, not too early of an adopter sometimes, can make tremendous impacts on production and sustainability of their operations.
Yeah.
And so that, I think that's really important is, you know, be willing to listen to change, because we don't always do things correctly. It's just, we've always done things.
Right. You know, I'm going to get off topic of cattle real quick. So my family, my father-in-law, they have sheep. And, when I showed up to the family, I was like, I'm going to run these animals like they're cows. I mean, they are ruminant. So we're just going to do it this way. And with what we have implemented and brought into the flock through some of my experiences and being open-minded, bringing the latest science, when we sell lambs over in Fort Collins, we usually set the market when we take ours over there, just because we've changed so many things and the growth rate of our animals and what they look like. It's just, you know, but again, that's being open-minded. And there's been times that he's questioned me on certain things we were doing, or I've made him work a little harder than we normally had to, especially when it comes to like putting cedars in and getting them all synced up to where we have a lambing window.
Right.
You know, we're lambing over 150 ewes in 25 days, where it used to be it took them 3 months. And, you know, we've tightened it up. So when all of our calves show up to the, or all of our lambs show up to the cell, they all look the same.
Uniform.
Uniformity.
Well, thanks, Jesse, for taking the time, jumping on the podcast. Really enjoyed talking to you about your experiences, what you're doing. You've done a tremendous job in Nebraska with BQA, and you've had a lot of producers in the state win awards. I believe you won award yourself.
I haven't won one yet. I can't wait till it comes. This year we did win two more. So as of right now, Nebraska has the most national beef quality award recognition in the nation. So we're leading the pack.
Great. And I'm sure you're having a big impact on the reason why. So thanks for jumping on. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Travis. It's great to be here.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.